Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. As always, I appreciate you joining me for a few minutes to look back at some of those baseball cards we have forgotten about. And today's show is all about the cards we have completely forgotten about. Yeah, we've spent plenty of time in the big old monster box. We are about to move on to the big old binder. Our next podcast on Tuesday, we'll go back in time to 1954 and start working through the older cards in my collection and kind of get back to the format that we had with the monster box, where we talk about the particular card, the design, some of the hits and misses in the set, and also a little background on the random player that we pull. And I think you're really going to like the 54 top show that we have, because it's not only a little history about the player, but a neat history about the team that he was on. In fact, the team that he came from had a pretty interesting history, and the team that he went to had a pretty neat history. And it all ties around the late, great Bill Veeck as well. So there's a little tease for Tuesday's podcast. But today's podcast is all about the miscellaneous baseball cards. And originally, when I had one of our listeners suggest that we do, you know, a few podcasts on minor league sets and team sets, he also mentioned no logo cards. I said, yeah, I've got a few of those, even though I've never liked no logo cards. I still have a few sitting in a box somewhere. Well, as I was looking through the box that is appropriately titled miscellaneous, and it's the same box that I got the 2002 Tampa Bay Devil Rays set out of that we talked about last time around, I found a whole assortment of cards that I said, you know what, I need to throw this into the no logo cards. So on top of no logo, we've got the Topps All-Star Glossy cards, which also features the All-Star Rookie Glossies. I forgot about those. I found one of those in there. But also other gems such as collectibooks. Remember those? So we'll look back at collectibooks here. And one of my favorite theme parks ever, Boardwalk and Baseball. They had some baseball cards that they sold outside of the, you know, standard Topps and Fleer and Donruss, but they had a very interesting set that they put out in the late 1980s. It wasn't really all that great, but it was kind of neat to stumble across those cards and go, hey, I get to talk about Boardwalk and Baseball for just a little bit. So we'll do that in a moment after we talk about what you're talking about at our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. As we always have fun commentary from our collectors there, make sure you pass along the Wax and Gum Stains Twitter feed to all of your friends, those who collect now, those who don't collect now but collected back in the day. I'm sure they'll enjoy the conversation that's there. You can talk about our podcast, the sets we talk about, the players we talk about, or just anything in general. And before we get to the commentary on Wax and Gum Stains, a couple of things about our distribution. As you know, we come your way twice a week, Tuesdays and Fridays, via Audio Boom and iTunes. Now, if you listen to us on iTunes, if you can do me a favor, when you get the chance, go back and rate the podcast. Put in any kind of comments, give us as many stars as you like. We just want to help spread our podcast out to others. And one way that we can do that, that we can grow the audience, is just have our current listeners, who again get it through the iTunes feed, just to rate the podcast. That way it gets bumped up on the iTunes chain and gets out to a few more people. And the more the merrier when you're talking about this. This isn't any kind of ploy to make money or hit some kind of mark for total listeners. We're just trying to grow the podcast a little bit. So again, if you listen via iTunes, if you can, just take a couple minutes to rate the podcast, and then that'll help us continue to grow it beyond our current audience. Now, we also hope to have some more exciting news. It's probably going to be early next week. I hope to have it on Tuesday. If I don't have it on Tuesday, I should have it by next Friday. But we are looking at another very big platform to deliver Wax Ecstatic on. And I'm going to leave it at that. But this will be a very big addition if we can make it happen. And I certainly believe that it will, because I know people. I know people who know people, and we'll get that type of stuff done. So stay tuned for that. Like I said, probably Tuesday or Friday, we will have that announcement. All right, let's go through the Wax and Gum Stains Twitter feed here. Beans Ball Card Blog, in response to our team sets, I found a bunch of these in a dime box a few weeks ago, and he sent a picture of the 1985 Performance Printing Texas Rangers team card. And this is just right up the alley of what we were talking about, you know, team cards or team sets prior to, you know, definitely 1990. But, you know, there was kind of a window late 80s, early 90s where the transition was made from just local or regional sponsor putting together a team set to team sets that were made by major card companies or were distributed by major card companies. Well, this is a prime example of this. Performance Printing was a printing company. I don't know if they still are, but a printing company in Dallas, Texas. So it's right down the street from the old Arlington Stadium. And it's a great picture here. It's of pitcher Dave Schmidt. And it looks like a spring training picture. He's wearing a home Rangers jersey, but he is definitely not in Arlington Stadium. Arlington Stadium had the blue background for, you know, the outfield wall and certainly the bleachers. So he's got this great picture here, and it actually looks like, as I try to zoom in on it, I'm having some trouble zooming in on the picture, but as I look at the picture, it looks like he's actually in the Rangers 1983 home uniform, which, by the way, is one of my favorite Rangers jerseys of all time. I've always thought that the Texas Rangers have had some pretty underrated jerseys, not recently. I've never really liked their jerseys ever since they moved into their current ballpark back in 94. I've never been a big fan of them. But I've always liked the Rangers early to mid 80s jerseys. But the ones they wore in 1983, it was 1983 only. And I can tell it's from 1983 because they had the Rangers logo back then, which back then was simply a gigantic T and R on a baseball. It was actually featured on the front of the jersey underneath the word Rangers. So it's a little outdated picture here, but it's a really cool jersey, and it's Schmidt in his delivery. And you flip it over on the back, and there it says Performance Printing. It says, this card comes to you with good wishes from your friends at Performance Printing. So that is the epitome of the locally owned or regionally owned business, basically putting up the money for the Texas Rangers to put together a card set. And, you know, you look at the front of the card, you look at the back of the card, it is very, very, very basic. In fact, a little too simple, a little primitive, even for 1985. But that is a great example of the pre-1990, let's say, team cards that you could probably only pick up at the Performance Printing locations around the Dallas-Fort Worth area back then, or on baseball card day at Arlington Stadium. And because Arlington Stadium was rarely full, even in 1985, you could probably pick them up on baseball card day and then pick up 10 more packs at your local Performance Printing store. So thank you so much, Beans Ball Card Blog, for sharing that with us. Another interesting team set, and this comes from Dub Mentality, who's a big Braves fan. He says, Tampa had Tropicana, and we had Likes. I remember getting this set at the ballpark and still have a few singles. And he shows us a picture of a 1992 Likes Mark Wohlers card. Remember Mark Wohlers? Wow, there's a blast from the past. And yeah, this is actually kind of late for the regional sponsorship, because by then, as I mentioned in the podcast, you have more and more high quality cards, or you know, major manufacturers making the cards. But this is a situation where Likes fronted the money and clearly got the approval of the Braves and the Players Association to use full team names and logos and jerseys and everything. But, you know, for 1992, it's a very basic design, and I just see the front of the card here. But that's a great example, too. You know, every market had a different sponsor or had a different source of money to finance these cards. So, yeah, we had Tropicana here in the Bay Area in 2002. In 1992, it was Likes with the Atlanta Braves. And somebody commented, who was it here? Barry W. If correct, he's the dude that lost his ability to throw strikes. His pitches bounced or soared to the backstop. Now, Dub Mentality says you're absolutely right. He got Steve Blass disease or Chuck Knobloch disease. Well, let me throw in another one, and I hope you weren't getting confused with this guy, but this is the most recent example. Rich Ankiel with the Cardinals. Now, he was totally losing his mental edge and just chucking pitches, you know, 80 feet into the air. But Rick Ankiel is a great example of that, and he was turned into an outfielder. The Cardinals figured, well, we've got a lot of time and money invested in this guy. If he's going to throw these fly balls from the pitcher's mound, at least, you know, we can move him out to center field and try him out there. And he actually had a fairly decent career with that position change. Another one for us older farts, Kevin Saucier, who was a relief pitcher for the Phillies, won the World Series with him in 1980. And then I think it was in 82, he beamed a batter. And after that hit by pitch, he could never pitch the same. He was just so scared of hitting another batter that he totally lost his placement of pitches, and his major league career was pretty much done. He was also, Kevin Saucier was the subject of an NFL Films documentary on Saucier when he was coming up through the minor leagues, and I always thought it was a great film. I saw it a long time ago, I think on ESPN Classic, and back then it was called Classic Sports Network. But NFL Films did a brief documentary, like a 30-minute documentary, 1973, I want to say, when Saucier was just starting his pro career and moving up through the Phillies farm system. And I've always thought that's a great concept, and it should be revisited nowadays, not just in baseball, but I think a lot of sports, following a player up from when he gets drafted or signed by a team to when he finally makes it to the majors is an awesome concept. And by the way, Dub Mentality has a really neat site, dubmentality.com, and he blogs about all things baseball and baseball cards. And he recently had a post about the top five Dubs snubs, the players who have not made it into the Hall of Fame. And he blames me. He says, thanks for making me totally obsessed with these players in the Hall. I won't take the blame. I don't always like having that as a topic of discussion. You know, I do like to mix it up a little bit. But considering, you know, of the last 10 or 12 podcasts we had from the Big Old Monster Box, probably about half of them had not made it to the Hall of Fame. And you know, we recently had that discussion about Will Clark in the Hall of Fame once again. Well, okay, I'll take a little bit of the percentage of guilt for that, but not a whole lot there. One other team set here, Christian Anderson, big Tigers fan, got these at a game in 1999. I've been trying to complete the set ever since. And this is Ballpark Hot Dogs and the Detroit Tigers. And it looks like a set of Tigers greats, of course, 1999, the last year of the old Tiger Stadium being in use. And he sends us a picture of Willie Horton, actually two cards. I see Willie Horton on the left and Mickey Lolick on the right. And a very neat sepia tone photograph, nice little biography of the players. So I wish you luck, Christian, in completing that set. That sounds like a really, really cool set. And finally, a very nice compliment from Shane Condon. Just found your podcast. Love it. These were my beginning years in collecting as well. 84 to be exact. Well, Shane, 1984 was a great year to start collecting. Of course, it comes off the incredibly great year of all of the sets, which was 1983. And I think that was the first year that all three sets were on a level playing field. All three sets put out some of their best material in 1983. And, you know, you had ups and downs starting in 84, actually 84 was pretty good for all three as well. But then, you know, 85, you know, you could say, well, Donruss slipped a little bit, or 86, you could say Topps slipped a little bit. But over the years, you know, especially in the mid 80s, you had some really quality products coming out from the big three back then. Topps, Fleer, and Donruss definitely in a battle to win the hearts and minds of baseball card collectors everywhere. Well, whatever is on your heart or mind about the industry, again, you can share it with us at Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter. about our podcast, about the players we talk about sets that you unearth in your collection. One of the favorite things about this podcast for me is taking a second look at some of the cards that we've forgotten about. And I'm sure with some of these team sets, and you know, if you're somebody like Shane and you know, you're going back 30 plus years ago and go, oh yeah, I remember that set. You know, it's neat to look back at some of these cards and go, wow. Yeah, you know, and even if the card wasn't that great or the player on the card wasn't that great, you know, even if you have a stack of common cards, it's still fun to go through the stack and see what's there and, you know, see what you can make of it. You know, you probably pull back a lot of great memories. You know, you may go, oh man, here's this, you know, 86 Baltimore Orioles card from a middle infielder that I didn't really know much about or care much about, but then some other memory from 1986, or you remember some other guy from Baltimore, or maybe this player played for your favorite team sometime later on down the line. So you always get a lot of great memories looking back at these cards. Now let's look back at some of the miscellaneous cards here. And I did, just like I did with the Devil Rays team set, I took just shots of the fronts of the cards with the exception of two of them. And I'll get into that in just a little bit. But I took shots of the fronts of these cards and basically pieced it together into one picture because the tweet deck wasn't necessarily assembling the photos like I wanted to. So I had to make one photo file. So click on it, zoom in, and follow along here, shall we? We're going to start, and you know, I've got a collection of pictures here of cards from this miscellaneous box. I'm just going to start from the bottom up and just talk about each and every one. I know the main focus was going to be no logo cards, so we're going to start there. No logo cards, as I've mentioned before, I have never been a big fan of. And you still have no logo cards today. And it's, you know, companies like Donruss, which is owned by Panini, they are not the official baseball card of Major League Baseball and the Players Association. So they can still create baseball cards, but they have to airbrush out logos. They have to airbrush out, you know, the team name on the jersey. And in some cases, what they have to do is not even call the team its name. You know, like the Boston Red Sox, they can't put Boston Red Sox because of trademark with the Red Sox. They just have to call them Boston to, you know, keep themselves safe in terms of trademarks. And that was the same case too. Think back in the day, late 80s, early 90s with video games. If you had a video game or a computer game that was not blessed by Major League Baseball and the Major League Baseball Players Association, you can tell if your game wasn't, because maybe the players and their old, you know, 8-bit dot matrix, you know, design on the computer screen, maybe they wore jerseys that looked like the right jersey. Maybe they had the same colors. But, you know, if you had a team, you know, let's say you were the Angels, instead of being referred to as the California Angels or the Angels, they were just referred to as California, then you know that it was not a blessed computer game or video game by MLB and the MLBPA. So I've never really cared for it because I've always thought it's kind of cheesy to have a card that has, you know, certain information blotted out because they didn't get the rights to do it. Now, with that said, that doesn't mean that the cards are cheap. It doesn't mean that there's no value to the cards. But, you know, what it means is, to me, it just comes off as cheap compared to the official cards that were made. So I was never a big collector of these, but chances are a lot of people weren't big collectors of these particular cards. So because of that, and because of the distribution of a lot of no-logo cards, which was typically through breakfast cereals, you know, stuff like that, these were cards that were damaged in the boxes. They were often lost or thrown out. So if you still have some of these cards, not necessarily from the 80s or 90s, but especially the breakfast cereal cards from the 1960s, there is a market out there for it. There is some value to these cards. You know, we're not talking 89 Upper Deck King Griffey Jr., but there are collectors who will gladly give you $2 or $3 for some of these cards. So let's look at three no-logo cards that were very interesting, in my opinion. First of all, we've got an older Wade Boggs card. This is the 1987 Collector's Edition Ralston Purina Company. Now, I am assuming that this came from a box of cereal. I don't think it came from a box of cereal in my house, because as I've shared the story with you, I didn't really start collecting until 1989. My younger brother didn't start collecting until about that same time. And my older brother collected in the early 80s, but not as ferociously as me or as my younger brother did. He collected cards from like 82, 83, and that was about it. So I may have gotten this in some kind of, the vintage, quote unquote, vintage assorted card boxes that I did go out and buy a few of when I was younger. But this is a very prototypical, you know, pre-flashy edition of the cereal baseball card. And as I mentioned, baseball cards were inserted into breakfast cereal boxes way before 1987. In fact, you could say 1957. It was a very easy thing to insert into cereal boxes. And much like the hook to getting kids to eat the McDonald's cheeseburger was the Happy Meal, it was the same thing with breakfast cereals, because you had your Frosted Flakes over here, you had your Fruit Loops over there, you had your Cocoa Puffs over there. Well, if you had a brand of cereal that was either not as popular as some of the more sugary, well-known brands, you know, like a Lucky Charm, something like that. Let's say you're selling Crispix or Corn Flakes or Kix or something like that. Those aren't the breakfast cereals that most kids gravitate towards. Trust me, I've got a 7-year-old. If there isn't 8 pounds of sugar in one serving of cereal, he doesn't like it. So to help boost sales, if you're the Ralston Purina Company and you're putting together, some breakfast cereals and you need a little bit of a boost from the younger audience, then what better way to do that than through baseball cards? So you have a very simple, cross bat appearance here, very little space for a picture. And it's just Wade Boggs staring off into space. Looks like it's spring training. They've got the B of his ball cap blotted out. A big Ralston Purina logo in the upper left, 1987 collector's edition in the upper right, and then very basically at the bottom says Wade Boggs, Boston Red Sox, third base. Now, let's fast forward 5 years, 1992. Now, this one I can tell you, it did come out of a cereal box because I did collect a few of these. And if I recall correctly, I think they packaged three in a box. They were, shrink-wrapped into a box. So I think I have six of these. So I have, I think Wade Boggs is one of them, Jose Canseco. Well, here's an example of one, Wally Joyner of the California Angels. And you can see a major difference in the design of these cards from 1987, when it was a mere throw-in, let's get a few more kids to buy our brand of cereal, to it's a mere throw-in, let's get some kids to buy some more cereal and try to create a little bit of a market for this. So Post in 1992 put together a pretty sharp card here that was, well, not in terms of like cardstock quality up there with the other cards in 92. In design, it was somewhat similar. You know, it wasn't all that different from, say, Donruss, Score. You know, it's just some very basic designs here, but very sharp with their logo in the upper left-hand corner. 1992 collector series across the top. Wally Joyner, his team underneath it. The MLBPA logo in the lower right-hand corner. And then a picture of Wally World swinging the bat in his California Angels uniform. Now, even though it had the MLBPA logo on it, it did not have the MLB logo on it. So because of that, you could use the likeness and the names of the players, but you couldn't use the team logos or jerseys. So again, another no logo example here. But even though you had the cheesiness and the cheapness of having to blot that out, this was actually still a very nice card put out by Post in 1992. So we've got two cards of two baseball players 5 years apart. You see the difference in the design, the quality, and kind of the intention of these cards going out. Let me present to you my third no-logo card. And this is one of my favorite cards ever. You know, I wasn't a big fan of no-logo cards, but when we started talking about no-logo, and in particular when we were talking about Will Clark in our 1988 Fleer podcast, I remembered this card. And I think it's valued at probably $5. I think there is a value to it. It's still just sitting in a cardboard box, but here it is. Milkbone Superstars. Yes, it does feature Will Clark in a rather clunky ripoff of the 84 Topps design, but really the superstar of the Milkbone set from 1993, limited edition, oh, by the way, is Will Clark's dog, Psycho, a beautiful black lab. Those are great dogs, by the way. And here he is. He's Psycho. And this is one of the two cards where I took a picture of the back of the card because it is so humorous. So we flip over the card, and you have, you know, Milkbone Superstars logo in the middle. And this is card number 7 of 20. And you have the Will Clark information, you know, his height and weight and where he was born and his birthday and his recent performance. They actually go back over the previous 5 years of his career. And you can tell that this was blessed by MLBPA, not only because it says so on the bottom with all of the copyrights, but also if you flip back to the front here, you've got Will Clark wearing the MLBPA ball cap here. But you'll notice in the inset picture, it's Clark at bat, but his back is to the camera, so you can't see any San Francisco Giants trademarks. But also in the recent performance stats listing, it just says San Francisco. So again, there's the key. They didn't use the word Giants anywhere on here. So you have the Will Clark information, but then you have the Psycho information. Psycho is a Labrador retriever, a male, born July 14th, 1985. Height was 25 inches, weight 95 pounds. That's a big beefy dog right there. So there you go. If you've ever wanted to know the size and weight and birth date of what is surely Will Clark's late dog, unless he's 32, which would be phenomenal. There you go. And, you know, we've talked about, and I know our friends at Baseball Card Backs are going to love this. We talk about some of the interesting little blurbs of information that have been written on the back of baseball cards. Well, here we go with Psycho. Psycho is a very obedient dog who loves the water and will do anything to retrieve something. So there is the scouting report on Psycho, the black lab retriever of Will Clark. Now, it doesn't say that Psycho will run over small children to retrieve something in the water. Labradors are a little more responsible than that, but one can use his or her imagination to that. So we have the career stats of Will Clark and the scouting report of Psycho the dog on the Milkbone 1993 limited edition Superstars trading card number 7 of 20. And that again just goes to the point that, you know, it goes to show by 1993 just how ridiculous baseball cards had gotten. You know, it wasn't just the major manufacturers. It wasn't just teams making sets. It wasn't just minor leagues making sets. It wasn't just Post Serial making a set. It was Milkbone. So, you know, Will Clark made probably, you know, a few thousand dollars in 1993 by pimping out his dog for the Milkbone Superstar card. But there you go. If you've ever wanted to know anything about Will Clark or his dog Psycho from 1993, it's right there. Card number 7 of 20 from the Surely Limited Edition. All right, so let's take a look at some of the logo cards that fit into the miscellaneous category, including the ubiquitous Topps Glossy All-Stars. Now, there were two ways that you got Topps Glossy All-Stars. The more popular way was to order them. You would see in the side wrappers of the 86, 87, 88, 89 Topps, there was often an offer on the side of the wrapper. Hey, kids, you know, send in this many wrappers and, you know, this much shipping and handling, and we'll send you 12 glossy All-Stars or something like that. I know in the 89 Topps, you used to get the insert card from the Topps store, which normally featured really 1989-esque clothing with the Topps logo written all over it. And I have to ask, do any of my listeners have Topps store clothing? Not the stuff you can buy now. They've got some cool retro things on the Topps website now. But I mean, In 1989, did you actually see a t-shirt on one of these Topps store cards that was in every wax pack? And did you go, I'm going to get me one of those? And did you get it? And do you still have it? That would be interesting if anybody still has it. If so, please share it at Wax and Gum Stains. I would love to see that. So one way that you can get the Topps Glossy All-Stars was a mail-in order. Or another way was the way that I procured a lot of these, again, the 250 quote-unquote vintage card boxes that you would get, you know, through Amway or through, you know, Pace Wholesale Club, Sam's Club back in the day. You got the 400 count box and they jammed 250 cards that nobody else really wanted. There's probably some limited numbers on because this is something that, again, you had to mail in to get. But knowing that they were also, reissued through the secondary market, like those vintage card boxes, I wouldn't exactly call this type of card rare. But it was a very basic and quite frankly, boring card. You know, here's a picture of Ozzie Smith in spring training hitting the ball. And it's just got this pink border. And the border often was associated with the team color. So, you know, if you had the Dodgers, you had a blue border. If you had the Mariners, it would be a gold border. But here's Ozzie Smith with the Cardinals, pink border around the card. And it just has his name in tiny, tiny letters at the bottom. And if you were to flip the card over, it just said Ozzie Smith on the back. You know, there was really no imagination to these cards. So it's an interesting piece of history in that it's a card that you had to go out of your way to get. But Topps didn't really make it anything special back then. So you may have collected a bunch of wrappers and sent in a few dollars. But other than the fact that these cards were glossy, in a day when cards were not glossy, not until the early 90s, that was pretty much it. There was really no good reason to go out of your way and get these. Now, as for the glossy all-star cards that you could get through rack packs, I've got one here of Ricky Henderson. Now, this would have come from an 87 Topps rack pack. And the rack packs from back then, again, especially 87, 88, 89, a lot of the times the All-Star card was featured front and center on the rack pack cells. You know, you had three little cells with 12 cards or 15 cards, however many cards were in each rack pack. And a lot of the times the All-Star card was just dangling right there. And I'm sure it's supposed to make you really want one All-Star over another. But especially as, you know, time went on and you could tell which player was a flash in the pan All-Star and which player was actually pretty decent, that may make you avoid buying a certain rack pack because this is an absolute dud player and a dud card, and I don't want it. Well, Ricky Henderson, not a dud, a 1986 All-Star here seen with the New York Yankees. And this is very typical design for not just 86, but basically for the next 3 or 4 years. The only change that Topps made was to the year at the top, but also on the back of the card, which was similar to the glossy All-Star cards, the back of the card, they would just change the color of it. So this one might have a dark blue background. The next one might have like a light pink background. The next one might have a light blue background. You know, they didn't really, again, put much imagination into this. But, you know, this was just the bonus card that you got. And it just showed the player in action. You know, this was a player who was on the 86 All-Star team. And if you were a fan of collecting All-Stars or Ricky Henderson, you could see front and center on the wax packs. These were the cards that you would get. Now, very similar to the All-Star cards, Topps would later do rookies inserts. And it was the same thing. These were featured in rack packs and I believe jumbo packs. And I've got one here of the 1989 rookies, and this would have been released in 1990, and here is Jim Abbott of the California Angels. Of course, great story of him getting to the major leagues, and very much like the All-Star cards, not a whole lot of imagination into the design on the front, certainly not the back. They would just change up colors again on the back, and that was about it. So, yeah, this was a nice little insert before insert cards became all the rage, but there was not really much incentive to go out of your way and get one of these. All right, a couple other interesting cards, and actually one card and then one interesting collectible from back then. Let's start with the card, the Danny Tartable Ultra Pro card. I have no idea why I still have this card. I don't know why I kept it. Again, you know, this is the early 90s. Now it's not just card companies who are fighting for your business, it's card supply companies. And you had to have certain plastic pages to put your cards in because there were some cheaper pages that would stick to the cards. Now, not like a glue stick, but, you know, could take a little bit of gloss and shine off a card. But then you had the Ultra company, which had what was really the preferred brand of plastic sheets that could also take care of the UV-coated cards. You know, it didn't peel onto the UV-coated cards, or anything on the UV-coated cards didn't peel off. So Ultra was pretty much the top-of-the-line brand, but you still had, you know, you could buy 10 sheets of Ultra for, say, $5, but you could buy 12 sheets of a lesser brand for $3.50. So Ultra had to up the ante a little bit. Clearly, they had the better product, but they needed the product spokesperson to help sell their product. So I remember, you know, you could actually buy baseball card supplies in the drugstores back in the early 90s. So I would go into a Walgreens if I needed some plastic sheets. And if they were selling Ultra Pro, well, you got your stack of 10 Ultra Pro sheets in one package, and inserted into one of the holders is Danny Tartable just smiling away, urging you to buy this brand of sheets. In fact, if you look at Danny Tartable here, he really follows you around the room. He is actually leering at you quite creepily. In fact, there's a little bit of a Mo Sizlak smile here for Danny Tartable. But, you know, Tartable was a spokesperson for Ultra. The Pro brand was one of the better brands. So, to, you know, much like the breakfast cereals, to entice you to buy one over the other, Ultra felt, okay, we've got to drop in these Danny Tartable cards to make it stand out. So again, I have no idea why I kept that one, but I did. All right, now the interesting collectible, and you saw a lot of these in the late 80s and early 90s, the collectibooks. Now, I do have maybe three or four of these. The one that I'm showing here is Jose Canseco, and I was never a big fan of these, and there's a couple of reasons why. One, because I like the simplicity of the baseball card. There's a front and a back, and all you need to know is on the stats and the little notes and scouting report on the back of the card. Collectibooks was that. It was a tiny baseball card size book that had basically like five pages of information. And if you were to open these up, you would have some stats, you would have a couple of action shots, you would have a narrative about that player's story. And then my favorite, and I didn't take a picture of this and I should have, but on the inside of the back cover, you had a quote from the player. And for this one, you know, Jose says, it's like, focus on all aspects of the game, fielding, catching, running, throwing, not just hitting. I don't know if Jose ever actually said that, but if he did, it's probably the brightest thing he's ever said in his life. So here's, you know, Canseco holding up his bat in the classic, I'm assuming this is probably 1989, Oakland A's jersey. You know, you got the elephant balancing on the ball on his sleeve. I love that element of the jersey. And then I did take a picture of the back because the back of each of these collected books had this really neat piece of art. And I know a couple of the other ones I have. I think I have Ted Williams and Bob Feller. So, you know, they did a Greats of the Game version of collectibooks. And here's Canseco and this nice little caricature of him. And it says, considered by many to be one of the top power hitters in the game today. In 1988, Jose became the first player ever to hit 40 home runs and steal 40 bases in one season. And this was officially licensed by MLB and the Major League Baseball Players Association, and it was made by CMC. If those letters sound familiar, that was one of the companies that started minor league cards. In fact, it was the company that started mass production of minor league cards. It was TCMA. And when TCMA couldn't really compete with Topps, Fleer, and Donruss in the 80s. They later changed their name to CMC, but they found a way to get into the business with the collectibooks. Now, the second reason why I was never a big fan of collectibooks, even though they were baseball card size, because they were books and they had this thick cardboard stock as a cover, you couldn't just drop these into a sleeve because it would probably fall out. It was just too big. So, you know, it would stretch a sleeve out. It would fall out if, you know, if you tilted the binder the wrong way. So they weren't very easy to collect. Like I said, I still do have some. They're kind of unique, but I was just never a big fan of them back then. And finally, the card that I really want to talk about, and really more the ballpark, or not the ballpark, the theme park, Boardwalk and Baseball. They released a set of cards in, I think, 1988, which was very similar to a brand of cards. I think it was, where did I read this? I think it was the KB Toy Store Company had a similar set of cards. It was a very small set. It was like 53 cards, something like that. And they were called Home Run Makers, which is a very silly name for a baseball card. Home Run Makers. It sounds like they should be doing a dance around the campfire. Oh, look, there's Bob Horner, you know, jiggling his fat, wearing the, you know, Indian outfit here to try to make it rain home runs. Well, Bob Horner, not dancing around like Chief Nakahoma, but about to put his weight into a swing at Fulton County Stadium, gracing the front of this card, a very 80s design with the MTV Cyndi Lauper pink border. Boardwalk and Baseball, so cool, just represented with B over B, which I believe was an algebra exam question. And then you've got the player's name there at the bottom. On the back, a very 80s back, and I don't have a picture of it, but you can Google image it and see it for yourself. Gray, pink back, and black back, I should say. Not a whole lot of information, just some stats. A thick cardstock, a little glossiness to it, but other than that, nothing to write home about. But with that said, it was a nice little keepsake from one of my favorite theme parks, Boardwalk and Baseball. I totally forgot that Boardwalk and Baseball was around for only 3 years. I was very fortunate growing up in Tampa. Boardwalk and Baseball was about 45 minutes away down I-4. If you're heading towards Orlando, Highway 27 is the crossover street. And north of that junction is the town of Davenport. South of that junction, as you go down 27, you go through Haines City, Winter Haven, Lake Wales, you know, some pretty, you know, red county voter areas of Central Florida. Used to be chock full of orange groves, but of course now those have been mowed over and there are subdivisions. A lot of people tend to retire to this part of the state too. It's a very quiet part of the state, not too many tourists, not too much activity. But Boardwalk and Baseball was formerly Circus World, and that theme park is what the name sounds like it was. It was just a circus-themed park that was around in the late 70s and early 80s and didn't survive. The Anheuser-Busch Company, which at the time owned Busch Gardens and SeaWorld, they bought the property. They decided, okay, we're going to mix it up here. We're going to make a baseball theme park. So Boardwalk and Baseball was created. And of course, Anheuser-Busch at the time owned the St. Louis Cardinals. The Kansas City Royals, ironically, you know, the cross-state rivals, would move their spring training operations into what was called Baseball City Stadium. And you had this theme park around the ballpark. And it was your typical theme park. You know, there was nothing extremely extraordinary about Boardwalk and Baseball. You had a really cool old-fashioned wooden roller coaster. I remember that real well. In fact, I think that was the first roller coaster I ever went on. And it was a thrill. I want to say it was called Cyclone, but I may be wrong on that. You know, you had your typical midway games. You had your typical, you know, here's the Ferris wheel and the merry-go-round and stuff like that. So, you know, in terms of theme park, nothing out of the ordinary, but you had that common theme of baseball. And they had a gift shop that sold baseball cards. And I wish, oh, how I wish, you know, back when I went to the park in 87, 88, I wish I'd bought some of the cards then. Of course, you know, I became a collector right before they closed their doors in 1990. But Boardwalk and Baseball was a lot of fun because it was a theme park. You had the baseball theme behind it. You knew there was a major league team that did their spring training. There was also a Florida State League team. The Royals Florida State League team was called the Baseball City Royals. They played their home games there. So you had a chance to go to a theme park and a ball game if you wanted to, which was kind of neat. And it kind of put that part of the state on the map because at least for a month, all the Kansas City Royals fans would come in on Davenport. And that was pretty much the bread and butter of, you know, the tourist industry back then for Davenport. There were two or three hotels nearby. You had the ballpark and the theme park, and that was pretty much it. Well, Boardwalk and Baseball failed for a number of reasons. One, it couldn't keep up with the changing theme park growth. And of course, the main element in theme park growth in Central Florida is Walt Disney World, which by the late 1980s had not only had Epcot under their wings, but they were building MGM Grand Studios. You had Universal Studios, which wasn't owned by Disney, but Universal Studios was also opening up at the same time. SeaWorld was starting to ramp up some of their entertainment options within the park. Busch Gardens was starting to as well. Busch Gardens would just start adding roller coasters upon roller coasters. So even though Anheuser-Busch owned both SeaWorld and Busch Gardens, they couldn't quite juice Boardwalk and Baseball. So it couldn't keep up with the competition. Davenport was not Orlando. Definitely not Orlando. There's so many entertainment options in Orlando. You can make a week of it in Orlando. If you try to make a week of it in Davenport, you're slitting your wrist by Tuesday. It's a very boring town. The other key part that a lot of people forget about is the fact that the economy was going down the tubes in the late 80s. There was a big stock market crash in October of 87, savings and loan crisis, the housing market was in flux, and especially in the state of Florida, everything rises and falls with the housing market. So the economy just was not in good enough shape. So even though Boardwalk and Baseball was a cheaper, somewhat more family-friendly option than some of the things you found in Orlando or Tampa, there just weren't enough people to justify it. So literally one day in 1990, they just closed the doors and people went to show up and there was no more theme park. And Boardwalk and Baseball was shuttered for, I want to say, 12 or 13 years. The Royals still had their spring training there up until, I think, 2002. Their Florida State League team wasn't there the whole time. They were only there for a few more years. But the land sat empty for several years, and then finally they redeveloped it into a shopping mall, which is just what you need in Florida. You know, if we can't have a shopping mall on every corner of an interstate junction, then we're just not doing our jobs here in the Sunshine State. So there's a shopping mall that now nobody goes to, as opposed to a theme park or a baseball stadium that nobody went to. And that's what happened with Boardwalk and Baseball. But for that little 3-year window, I was very fortunate, again, because I lived nearby. We had family passage to the Busch theme parks. Busch Entertainment, by the way, also owned Cypress Gardens at that time in Winter Haven. Cypress Gardens, that property is now Legoland. So it was a good value for my family. This was back in the day when you could get into a theme park for like $30. I mean, you know, now a hot dog and a Coke is $30 at a theme park. But it was a good family value, so we had the family passes, and because we weren't that far away, we went to Boardwalk and Baseball at least twice, maybe three times, if memory serves correct. And even though there was nothing that really stood out other than the roller coaster, which I remember, and the fact that there was a baseball theme and a stadium and cards there, I had a lot of great memories there. So if you were able to make it to Boardwalk and Baseball from 1987 to 1990, share it with us at Wax and Gum Stains. I still think somewhere, I have no idea where, somewhere in my house, I still have a pamphlet, the park map from Boardwalk and Baseball. I think right before they closed, like 89 or 90. I just remembered my elementary school safety patrol class, that was fifth grade for us. We went to Boardwalk and Baseball as an end of the year prize. I just remembered that. There's another visit to Boardwalk and Baseball with good friends of mine at the age of 9, 10 years old. So that would have been in 1988. So yeah, it's a lot of great memories there, and seeing this card, even though it's a really ugly, clunky card, brought back a lot of great memories just of that ballpark. So there you go, our miscellaneous pile of cards here, and that will conclude our podcast from the miscellaneous box of minor league cards, miscellaneous cards, and team sets here. Your thoughts, any cards that you want to share again at Wax and Gum Stains, please do that. And again, join us on Tuesday for our next podcast as we will be traveling back to 1954. We'll start the big old binder. We'll have a card from 1954, the one card from 1954 I have. Skip a couple years, and then we'll go from 1957 right on up through 1980. All Topps cards, but some pretty interesting cards, players, and stories behind the players and the teams that they played for. So we will start doing that Tuesday. Again, hope to have some exciting news on our distribution on Tuesday, and hope to have you joining us as well as we continue our look back at some of the great cards and not so great cards of our collecting lives. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks again for tuning in to Wax Ecstatic. We'll see you next time.